live with. It's going to stay there. It has to stay there. There's no way around it. And you can see some of the sort of comparisons between the size of the pools. These figures are controversial, of course, but I think it gives a basic idea of the thing. Four trillion tons of carbon and fossil fuels, and just compare that to the amount in the trees and the living biomass. And you can see and the atmosphere, of course, which is even less. You can sort of see the nature of the problem. I mean, the carbon above the ground, of course, circulates, among the atmosphere, vegetation, and oceans. But the important fact about these two carbon pools is once the carbon comes out of the ground, it doesn't go back. Well, of course, it does go back. If you've got a few million years of time to spare, the coal will reform and the oil will reform and so forth. But in humanly meaningful time spans, this carbon that gets up here out of the ground is not going to go back. And that's a problem, and that's why fossil fuels are going to have to stay in the ground.
That's not quite true. About a third of the carbon that goes up goes back in the oceans.
Yeah, no, I'm including the oceans as part of that above ground system, actually.
You see
the oceans are, they are up here circulating among the oceans are a huge store. But the point is, once it's in the oceans, it's not actually going back
into the
fossil fuels. What this suggests to me is that, to deal with this basic problem, there's no way around that kind of solution, basically putting a cork in it. I've got some quotations here just to sort of, this is the sort of stuff that people are talking about in Europe, this year. It's beginning to be recognized that, emissions trading, this reliance on price mechanisms, actually has some problems when we're talking about the specific nature of the global warming problem. For example, Jim Watson, who's an academic at Sussex University, says, governments are relying way too much on the price of carbon to deliver everything. It has to go hand in hand with regulations and technological developments, and they're sadly lacking. Serious step changes are not going to be accomplished by marginal changes in price. Dieter Helm, very distinguished energy economist at Oxford, price of carbon has had virtually no effect on the market so far and virtually no effect on climate change. There must be more focus on energy efficiency, more research and development, and more renewable energy. Right. You can see a variety of authors from academia and from business. Deutsche Bank is not exactly your wild-eyed, greedy organization, but they say something funny going on here. Coal plants are receiving more allowances than eco-friendly fuels. EU ETS has not encouraged meaningful investment in carbon-reducing technologies. Margaret Taylor at Berkeley points out that even if you look at the precedent of the sulfur dioxide system, this is not bringing about structural change. Even this great supposed success of the sulfur dioxide system, what it did was it encouraged a few little changes around the margin, but it's actually not. It's not encouraging technological innovation. I'm not going to go into this, but there's this whole question of the fact that we're locked into the fossil fuel system, and the problem is to how to deal with that lock-in and how to lock in a more climate-friendly system. And economists like this guy, Brian Arthur at Stanford, I guess he's not Santa Fe Institute, have recently put a lot of economic theory around this point by saying, well, actually, history matters. Even in economics, history matters. Where you're starting from matters. If you get locked into a certain path, you're going to follow that path. And price is not really important. If you look at history, price is not really important in dealing with those historical patterns like global warming presents us with. Steve Weiner at Oxford Business School, Gwyn Prince at LSE, London School of Economics, similar view. Without a significant increase in publicly funded research and development, there will be considerable delay before innovation catches up with a modest price signal. Going quickly on to this business of property rights and cap and trade systems, again, as your ambassador from Europe, I suppose I should report a little bit of what's going on there. And again, I'm just talking about cap and trade here. I'm not talking about offsets yet. So I'll try to go quickly through this. this goes back to the point I mentioned earlier about, you know, in the 19th century and before, all the way back to the 13th century, actually, how land was privatized in the enclosure movement. And it's not quite the same thing, but in the EU emissions trading system over the last 3 years, there has been a noticeable privatization of the world carbon dump through the European emissions trading scheme. And this shows a little bit of the mechanics of how it's working. In Europe, the governments are given the power to allocate to their countries a certain number of pollution rights or greenhouse gas emissions rights. And all of the European governments have chosen to give those rights to not you and me, not the sort of average individual. They've given the rights to the biggest polluting corporations, the ones who are emitting the most fossil fuels. So the guys who get this gift of free emissions rights in Europe from all of these governments, France, Germany, Netherlands, and so forth, are actually the power generators, iron and steel industry, oil and gas industry, cement, chemicals, and so forth. These corporations are actually getting free rights to pollute. I'll say that again because sometimes people don't believe it. They are not being sold these rights. They're not being auctioned. They're being given these pollution rights for free. The corporate sector is getting a free handout from the government of pollution rights. And how much of these pollution rights are they being given? Well, the second column gives you some idea. This compares the 2005 actual emissions of these countries in large industrial sectors with the gift of pollution rights they were given. And well, you can compare the figures for yourself. In the first phase, they're actually being given more rights to pollute than they were already polluting, if you can believe that. But it's true. So everybody said, okay, well, we'll make it better next time. It's not going to be this time. We can do it better. So phase two, okay, well, we'll cut the emissions rights that we hand out to our big corporations. Well, you know, they tried, and the EU, to its credit, has certainly tried to enforce a little bit of cuts among the participating governments. But you can see the success hasn't been exactly notable, even in phase two. Just briefly, this is a very political column. Nobody can estimate scientifically how much, you know, of the world carbon dump is actually available to us, because that depends not only on unsolvable scientific climatological questions, but it also, you know, depends on politics. Well, how much is actually available depends on what kind of world we want, whether we want to live in a 200-degree Fahrenheit world or we want to live in a different kind of world. But just for laughs, I did a little arithmetic based on the IPCC's old claim that we have to reduce 60-80%, if we're going to stabilize atmospheric concentrations. And, you know, if we take that as a starting point for how much carbon dump is actually available to us to dump our carbon dioxide in, what we come up with is something like this. This is how much of the world's carbon dump that European governments have given to their large private polluting corporations. And if you look it up, the figures add up to it. It adds up to the fact that between 17 and 34% of the available world's common carbon dumping space has been given by European governments to European corporations. Well, that raises some economic questions, but it also raises some political questions. I mean, what's the population of Europe compared to the population of the world? Because after all, the carbon dump that the European governments are giving away is actually not just a European dump. I mean, you know, it's the whole world's dump. It's the dump that we use, that the Bangladesh Rice Fund uses, and so forth. And they've given away this much of that to European governments. Who exactly gave them the right to give away that asset? And it is an asset. To large polluting private corporations who are actually the major source of the global warming problem. Well, the answer is nobody. They took that. They took that power, and they gave away. And they gave away those assets. And nobody actually talked about it on the evening news, and nobody actually reported it in the newspaper in that way. But that's what happened. Well, you might say, well, okay, but this is, you know, what does this have to do with economics? Well, quite a bit, actually, because these assets have a value, and they're referred to as assets by Wall Street, by the City of London Financial District, and by the corporations and all their accountants. And, you know, it depends on what the price of carbon is, but, you know, the assets have a real monetary value. And this, you know, on the assumption that you have a carbon price of 30 euros per ton, which you don't actually have, right now, but if you did, it would mean, you know, order of 50 billion euros being given away free every year by European governments to European corporations. That's a political point, but it has some economic consequences and some scientific global warming climatological consequences as well, because what it means is windfall profit. What it's meant so far in Europe has been windfall profits for fossil fuel intensive corporations. The very guys we're sort of mostly concerned about have been getting extra money from the carbon market to do what they're doing already, which is burn fossil fuels. The big six electricity generators in the country I'm from are getting a handout of over $1 billion a year, which they can use for anything they like, from this free gift of assets. Czech Republic is very explicit. The chief executive officer of a Czech generator is very explicit in saying he's using the money to launch more coal production. Let's just back up a minute and remind ourselves that this whole system is supposedly dealing with the global warming problem, yet it's actually subsidizing more coal production. And of course, you know, this gets back to some of the quotations I was putting up before about he's getting the benefit from this. So, you know, some of the conflicts, the political conflicts that all of this sets up, I mean, I think you can imagine them, just to go over them briefly, you know, the colonialist system, there's conflicts within the business community, you know, you're giving that guy too much, you know, too many emissions rights, you know, I want more, you know, it's not fair. Between business and government, you know, there's all sorts of lawsuits and disputes breaking out between governments and their industries about how much handouts they're getting. You know, give us more. I mean, everybody wants the market to work. Everybody wants there to be scarcity. Yet at the same time, you know, all the big players also want as many rights as they can get, as many pollution rights as they can get. And of course, this is now leading to conflicts between carbon traders, carbon trading proponents, and environmentalists in the public more and more. At least in Europe, probably not here yet. Right. This I'm going to talk about a bit more later, but just to briefly mention, many people say, well, cap and trade, you know, it's an economic instrument. It's just a market tool. It's compatible with anything. You know, it just makes anything we do more efficient. Well, no. Actually, these economic instruments, so-called, also have a particular political function. There are beneficiaries and there are losers. For example, you know, subsidy shifting, you know, the shift of resources toward the shift of, you know, public resources toward support of renewables, support of different ways of organizing our communities and different ways of transport and so forth is suffering. There are cases in which, you know, public investment in structural change, like in the UK in renewable energy, is actually threatened by the cap and trade system instituted under the EU. I mean, recently there was news that, you know, the renewable energy support program of the UK was revealed in a secret memorandum leaked to the press to be under threat. In fact, they decided to cut it because they said, oh, well, it might be incompatible with the EU emissions trading scheme. We don't want to support our renewables industry too much with subsidies from the public purse because that would be incompatible with the EU emissions trading scheme, and especially with our booming carbon broker industry in the City of London, which is like the world capital of carbon trading now. Denmark, a lot of activists in Denmark are wondering what's going on because Denmark actually has a lead in things like wind energy because of previous conventional regulation, which sort of made a lot of the, you know, a lot of the firms there have to take an interest in wind energy. And now there's a sort of new market-oriented government there saying, okay, well, no, forget about that. You know, cap and trade will give us what we want. And the activists are asking, well, why don't we look at history and see what actually has brought about the kind of innovation that we want in the past before we jump to the conclusion that, you know, market solutions are going to give us, or trading solutions are going to give us what we need. I'm going to talk about that later in connection with carbon offsets, so I'll leave that for now. Let me just skip over some of these. That probably takes a lot of time. Let me stop that for now. Let me move right on to offsets, because I think that's a thing that can interest a lot of you, because everybody seems to be sort of involved in this carbon, or interested in this carbon neutrality, carbon offsets part. This, as I said, this is the second part of trading, and it has a set of problems which are similar, but there are some special problems connected with offsets. Just to review quickly what offsets are sort of like in theory. It's a bit more complicated. The idea is that instead of making a reduction, instead of actually moving from here to here and cutting down the smoke coming out of your stack, what you do is you can continue polluting, but you add an offset. For example, you do a tree plantation which supposedly soaks up the carbon that's coming out of your smokestack, so it becomes equal to that. Or you, and this is a bit more complicated, you set up a windmill. You pay somebody to set up a windmill in some other country or some other place, and you say, well, that windmill is actually saving carbon. You might ask, well, how does that work? And the answer is very complicated, very sophisticated. The answer is that the windmill is supposed to be saving carbon above and beyond what would have happened otherwise. What would have happened without the money that you get from the carbon credit buyer, without the carbon market? So the carbon market is supposed to provide additional money which enables the windmill to happen, and it would not have happened otherwise. Okay, you may ask, well, who decides what would have happened otherwise? But we'll get to that later. That's the theory. That's sort of the theory of offsets. Does everybody know that already? Is that sort of common knowledge among all of you environmental studies? Yeah, okay. I just to go over it briefly. I'm going to go over several of these problems, with specific problems with the offset market, but let me just start with something which sort of will give you the general orientation. This is from Eva Lofrand, a Swedish researcher, and she's trying to point out that this thing is not just a matter of economics and science, it's very political. The carbon offset market epitomizes continued neoliberal governance building on a capitalist compact between business and government elites and industrialized and developing countries. Rather than providing a multitude of benefits for all involved, the CDM market, and don't be afraid of CDM, it just means a kind of offsets, the official kind of offsets under the Kyoto Protocol, whereby industrialized countries or firms pay somebody in the South, the global South, to do an offset project. And it's all governed under the Kyoto Protocol. Anyway, that market appears to be deeply embedded in global power structures that effectively marginalize local actors. And I'll show you some pictures that sort of will demonstrate how that plays out in some local areas and reproduce patterns of inequity. Right, and in similar vein, the technocratic apparatus contradicts the image of an international climate regime as an expression of a less state-centric and just market order. Anyway, that just to give you sort of orientation. The tree plantation example, again, I'm very proud of these pictures because they took me a long time to draw. The tree plantation example sort of works like this in theory. The black stuff coming out of the ground into the atmosphere and the oceans and the trees and everything. But it's okay, it doesn't build up in the atmosphere because you're planting trees to soak it up. That's sort of the very graphic representation of how it works. And of course the windmill example, as I mentioned, is different. One of the problems that strikes a lot of people that I talk to offhand about this is that by the logic of it, if you carry it to its logical conclusion, it's a bit weird because it looks like, well, it's okay to go on expanding your fossil fuel burning capacity as long as you've got a tree plantation somewhere or you've got a windmill somewhere else. And by the logic of it, carried to the extreme case, what that means is that you have a landscape in which all the fossil fuels are being burned up or have been burned up, and a landscape which is also full of windmills and trees, but the problem actually hasn't been solved because all of the fossil fuels have been transferred into the oceans, into the atmosphere, into the above ground system, and you haven't really dealt with the global warming problem. That's just sort of a common sense thing that strikes many people, and I think there's a lot of it's worth mentioning.
In fact, if people are interested in looking a little more at kind of a funny way of looking at the incoherence of the argument that offsets. There's an amazing website out there called cheapneutral.com, which takes the idea of offsetting your sins to relationships. And so it's okay if you cheat on your significant other as long as you're paying somewhere else out there to remain grateful for the total amount of cheating you know, and you and you can print yourself as a little like things are like this. Here's the couple that you're sponsoring to stay monogamous, so you can go on and be happy and be feel free.
Cheapneutral.com. Cheapneutral.com. See, I guess the logic would be, yeah, well, in that case, you know, why don't we all forget about, you know, being faithful? Because
you have to be a little careful in that. It's a bit flipped.
And of course it is.
From a carbon standpoint, because the atmosphere really cares about carbon and the net carbon. And so the windmill, if you really do it strictly, it is actually correct that the analogy is not incoherent. It is carbon neutral in the sense that you would be displacing the oil with wind because there'd be less demand for oil. And the trees would, one for one, pick up a molecule of carbon out of the atmosphere and offset it. You can argue about the mechanism, but the carbon is actually correct. And the idea is not incoherent, and nor is it inappropriate.
Well, actually, I would argue that... But maybe, yeah.
I have a question. I'm not environmentally, but I'm...
The trees. First of all, it's not tree plantations, and it's about carbon in trees. Again, the implementation issue can be argued on whether it's being implemented correctly. But a molecule of carbon picked up through increased photosynthesis, increased fixation, will offset all molecule to molecule carbon that will come off of the oil. I mean, that's not. I don't think there's anything debatable about that. I mean, that's scientifically correct. It's straightforward. Then you have to argue about whether the implementation is in fact having that effect. But the concept of watching a molecule of carbon is correct, does work, and I don't think there's the science under it is not, that's not a debatable point. The question is the implementation, and whether or not in fact it's getting implemented that way is really the issue.
I mean, implementation certainly is an issue, but actually, the incoherence is concealed when you do look at it at, you know, the project by project level, and you say, okay, in an ideal.
That's implementation. Okay, so projects, that's an implementation issue as opposed to...
No, I'm not talking about implementation. I'm saying, suppose, leave the implementation issue aside. I mean, suppose you have, you know, a good individual project where every carbon molecule emitted by the smokestack is actually absorbed by the tree, and you can verify that. At that level, I agree, you know, the incoherence doesn't appear. It's only when you look at the sort of macro level and draw things to their logical conclusion that you see that actually this is compatible with the extraction of all the remaining... I mean, of course, it's not going to happen. I mean, we all know that. It's just, it's flip, as you say. But it is compatible, logically speaking, with extracting all remaining fossil fuels and covering, you know, several extra planets with trees. And that should raise some important questions.
Wouldn't it, like, if you wanted to reforest to offset more fossil fuel extraction, wouldn't it become more and more difficult? Wouldn't we run out of land to keep working? So wouldn't, at some point, if
the question is, you're absolutely right. The theory is that, okay, once we've covered the Earth with trees, of course, we're going to have to do something else, you know, and it's going to be more difficult to find the cheap solution of trees, so, you know, we'll have to do something serious about, you know, changing the way we use fossil fuels, and that's absolutely correct. But, you know, there are some questions that have to be raised about this. I mean, first, the obvious political question is whose land are you using, and how many extra planets are you going to need, to plant the trees on? But as you say, we eventually run out of land. Even if we take over everybody's land and plant trees, we run out of land. We have to do something else. But I think the central question gets back to this issue of innovation and structural change. If we can put off action by, you know, 5 or 10 years by engaging in these complicated, biotic sequestration projects, you know, the question is, do we really want to do that given the urgency that the governments are all telling us about how we need to undertake structural change in the fossil-dependent system now rather than in, 2 years or 5 years' time? So I think that's
sort of a question of timeline in terms of the carbon molecule in the fossil fuel equals the carbon molecule in the tree, is the question that the fossil fuels are stored in the ground for millions and millions of years. From our human time scale, it seems like an infinite amount of time that they will stay there. Whereas a tree has a lifetime of 1500 old growth, even 200 years old. And when this kind of logic of this tree equals this amount of driving, or this tree equals this amount of energy coming from a fossil fuel planet, that's assuming that that tree is going to infinitely hold on to that carbon molecule. And it's also the question of, since a lot of these are implemented in terms of plantations, these plantations are often where there used to be old growth rainforest that is a permanent carbon store, whereas the tree plantations are a rapidly cycling, like the ones in Brazil are tree plantations for paper and for burning to make charcoal, which is used to produce pig iron, which is used in the automotive industry. So this, and that's in terms of plantations, you also have a question of the whole history of plantations and where the idea of plantations come from in terms of modern of agriculture, and how does that tie to the colonization of the Americas in terms of this idea of a large scale monocrop, idea of doing things that they're taking over land for projects, the term is something else.
Yeah, the problem that Julian talks about, actually, of course, there, you know, if you put that to a technician, you know, there will be an answer. You know, there will, you know, fudge factor depending on how long the trees actually do last, given that they will be cut down and so forth. But you know, I don't want to get into that other than the direction in which this is leading. You know, toward these one technical fix after another to try to sort of fudge away the basic problem. Was there something else over here?
Yeah, you might touch on this later, in which case that's fine. But the kind of question that's more has to do with the renewable energy aspect to it. So taking for granted that countries are growing, that they're going to want electricity, and that's not something that we're really going to be able to debate, since China is just growing rapidly. Renewable energy technology is just, as from a supply side, costs considerably more than coal, oil. And the offsets provide a way to neutralize that that cost. So
sorry, could you explain that?
If you're able to build a wind farm and half your inputs are coming in from your CDRs, which is CDM payments, if you weren't to build that wind farm, it's going to take you twice as long to pay it off, in which case a country like China on a large scale isn't going to invest in a technology that's going to cost twice as much when there isn't that. They have an externalized CO2. So, I mean, I guess my question is, I guess you'll probably answer towards the end, is how else would you get people to build renewable energy when it's going to cost twice as much?
Well, yeah, I was going to go and do a bit of that later, but since you bring it up, I think that's very important, because that's, you know, in a sense what you refer to as the CDM, which is this clean development mechanism, which is a sort of offset project under the Kyoto Protocol. I mean, one of the big justifications for that, in addition to the fact that it, you know, supposedly brings in the South, southern countries to participate in the Kyoto Protocol, one of the big justifications is, you know, as you say, well, you know, where are we going to get the finance, for example, for you know, renewable energy to become more possible in the South? You know, people need energy, and you know, you're going to need money for these more expensive renewable projects if for example, China or India are going to skip over or jump over the mistakes of the West in dependence on fossil fuel. Where is this money going to come from? One of the answers is, well, carbon trading can provide that. Offset trading can provide it, because for example, you get carbon money for setting up a windmill, which supposedly saves carbon above and beyond what would have been otherwise. So without the carbon money, you don't have the windmill. Other kinds of renewable energy, solar or whatever. And that's nice. It's a nice classroom theory. But when you look at the reality, and when you look at the way the market actually works, and when you look at the structure, the underlying structure of this market, that's actually not the way things work. The money is not going to sort of a renewable transition in the South, and it's not going to go there for a long time. And it's not just an accidental measure, an accidental problem of enforcement or implementation that it's not going there. It's a structural problem with the market itself. So I'll just jump to this point quickly, because it's a good point. The question is this true? is this true what you say? For example, you know, is this leading to a clean energy transition in the South? And, well, in the North, of course, it isn't, because it's helping the North continue business as usual with fossil fuels, because the North is paying to be allowed to do that through these offsets. But also in the South, it's not leading to the sort of renewable transition you're talking about. If you look at the reality, for example, and we're just on a level of facts here, CDM credits in the pipeline to 2012%, you can see, you know, they're going to these things which actually don't have a whole lot to do with the transition away from fossil fuels. The top category is a sort of category of machines which you bolt onto an existing factory to capture and destroy these very powerful greenhouse gases called HFCs and NO2. 40% of all CDM credits come from these things, and these are not contributing to structural change in the way fossil fuels are used in southern countries. It's not you know, helping, you know, southern countries onto a sustainable development path. It's just a way of making a lot of money by the factory owners, the people who actually own those particular factories, for making a sort of, you know, improvement that arguably should have been made anyway. A lot of credits are coming from things like coal bed mine methane, switching of fuels, and so forth. In fact, I never tried to make this diagram to show the percentage of, you know, renewable energy in terms of credits coming from the CDM, and you can guess which slice is actually things like solar and wind and geothermal. Yes, it's the tiny little slice. That's actually the way things are going now with the CDM. And, you know, there's structural reasons for that. As one of the biggest buyers of carbon credits, a guy named Jack Coben, who's the CEO of a company called NatSource, put it very frankly in a room where I was listening in the Montreal climate negotiations in 2005. He said, you know, the carbon market doesn't care about sustainable development. The carbon market cares about the carbon price. And that's a very profound and important statement. Buyers of carbon credits are looking for big blocks of cheap credits, which can be obtained from the easiest sort of method available. And the easiest method available is not renewable energy. Okay. These are very difficult projects. The more effective ones are very fiddly. You've got to deal with communities. And as somebody from Rabobank said at another business conference, very frankly, we can't deal with communities.